let's pull this into the station and call it a day. All right. Emily, you don't have food in your mouth. Can I ask you to read this?
Sure. In terms of relative emphasis, I think it is fair to suggest that issues at the bedside, such topics as informed consent, capacity assessment, and end-of-life care, for example, receive considerably more attention than broader explorations of ethical issues related to what are often called the social determinant of health and illness. Moral analysis in bioethics is now typically placed in a social context, but all too often, that context is one occupied by the relatively wealthy and the comparatively privileged.
Thank you. So this brings me to the sort of twofold reason for the perspective that I have taken in this class, is that yes, there's these things called culture we have to pay attention to, and number two, we have to do it in a way that takes into account social inequities and social justice. And I think the reason that this is sometimes doesn't come naturally, or is in some cases not the dominant way in which bioethics is done, at least in the United States, or at least at Penn in the United States, is that there is this cultural boundedness of bioethics. That subjects are studied and discussed in ways that reflect U.S. preoccupations. So that, and again, we've talked about this a lot throughout the course of the semester, this is tying it all together in one final oomph. We talk about the rights of individuals, fairness, regulations, guidelines. We talk about a particular logic, individuals being a particular kind of rational. We look for codified rules and techniques, rigorous, precise, and objective thinking. So in order to, I think we need to expand what it is we're talking about when we talk about bioethics. How do we do that? I have five goals that I want everyone to take with them. Goal number one is that we need to better utilize ethnographic information. And again, in order to understand the dilemma, you have to understand the context in which it occurs. And I want to argue that that context is larger than just, you know, is it in an oncology clinic? Is it a primary care office? Is it an inpatient? I want to know who are the players. I want to know the slinkies of the players, of both players. I think that if you disregard ethnographic information and you focus on a more abstract version of moral reasoning, it turns culture and personal social meanings into noise that has to be silenced in order for dilemmas to reach resolution, is the way the common thinking goes. So it's either noise or, even worse, constraints or barriers. That's why a lot of cultural competency type classes start with, here's a barrier, here's a problem that came about because of cultural differences. It implies that culture is a barrier to ethical resolution, not that culture can be an integral part to a resolution of an ethical dilemma. And also that, usually as it's done, that culture is a barrier that the patient has, or the person that is of the other culture has. Implies that there's something universal, or at least superlative, or better on the other side of that barrier.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In this moral reason, isn't that a way to incorporate religion when you say moral reason? How can you distinguish between religion and moral reason?
Because point number three will be that we have to expand away from the secular focus of bioethics. No, moral reasoning will, is that point number two? Yeah, oh, hello, thank you. Then we need to broaden this, that typically bioethics is done in a way that seeks a very secular approach. The idea being that if you can secularize yourself, you can then apply it more judiciously and more favorably and fairly to people of multiple different cultures. It's designed intellectually as an approach that is practical and moral. And like I said, people will argue that it's better able to serve pluralistic societies. However, as Celia is saying, Doing this isolates ethical issues from their spiritual and social context, which I say makes our approach limited, incomplete, devoid, maybe too strong of a word, but you know where I'm going, of meaning difficult to understand for many who don't share that secular bias. And what do they say the number, I mean, something like, it's greater than a majority of people in the United States truly believe that prayer can heal illness. So you don't have to just think about the Hmong with their belief in spirit possession to talk about difficult to understand for people who aren't, you know, you think secular United States people, you know, religious other types of people. But that is not true, as we all know. Goal number three, move away from dichotomies. The idea of principles are often presented as either or, and this is how, and Anna, this will be your job in FR 601 whenever you have your students in your class start talking about, because that's going to be the outline that's going to be given to you. Okay. What are the two principles in conflict in this dilemma and how do we resolve them? Try to move them away from the dichotomy to triads and slinkies. And as we've seen in some of the examples from this class, and even just for many of us here think this way, the moral order, where opposites are complementary, they are not mutually exclusive. Where goal is sort of a dynamic equilibrium, not a one over the other. Moving away from dichotomies, I think, will also get us to dynamic concepts of people, family, and community. The idea that what it is to be a person is fundamentally related to what it means to be in a person in relation to you. this point right here, in relation to other people, is key when we're talking about an ethics of care. That is so fundamental that it is often masked over, clouded over, when you're looking at ethics in terms of dichotomous principles. And we'll get to that in point number five. I don't know, my broken horse, mixing metaphors. The horse that I'm beating, that, as we've seen, concept of autonomy remains the intellectual and moral foundation, relates to the Western concept of the individual, in other cultures, and I would argue in our own. While it may not completely negate, it suppresses the vital role of personal interconnectedness. And I'm stopping beating right now. Highlight other values, and here's where the sort of people in relation to other people and the Weingarten article start to come into play. Kazunai. Problem with the absolutization of patient autonomy is that it ignores the duties we owe others as members of the human community. Diminishing or suppressing communitarian ethics or common good, social justice, solidarity, other types of principles. So highlighting other values, it goes back to the argument that we made last week about adding principles if we want to stick to them, reordering them. Weingarten, you know, sort of as just, he says, no, right, with the, in highlighting informed consent based on the highlighting of autonomy, in some ways, again, this is not saying an individual practitioner-patient interrelation that the doctor is absolved of a personal relationship, but on some level you can look at the doctrine of informed consent as something that does. It protects patients based on a set of rights. Absolving, as Weingarten says, and he's, you know, not all of you are going to agree as much as I do with him, takes away something from the personal involvement of a practitioner with a patient. This pissed a lot of people off in the summer class, where he says the have-nots are transparent people, not Kantian ends to themselves. And I think what he is expressing here is the frustration within bioethics, as he says, it's, you know, Western-bound bioethics, the frustration that Turner expressed in his quote is that we're starting to talk about context, but we're still talking about the context of privilege and the context of a very particular subset of the population. We're not taking into account what he calls the transparent people. And that could be on a global stage, it could be the global poor. On a local stage, it's people in the heart of West Philly and the heart of North Philly. So that I think what he's saying is, no matter how much we talk the talk of the importance of treating people as ends in themselves and not means, that the transparent, the have-nots becomes transparent. And he talks about the challenge of being pluralistic, not just tolerant. In my gloss over, and it's a great article, if you didn't have a chance to read it, I highly recommend it. The idea that a tolerant society, which is the easier of these two, is that you still maintain that sense of, all right, well, we'll tolerate beliefs of others, but we're not going to fully engage with them in the way that we would in a pluralist society, in which we recognize on some level, when you bring it down to the individual, and again, I know a lot of you think, well, what about fetuses? What about young children? What about mentally ill? Those are details that can be worked out. And that the challenge is being pluralistic and recognizing the equal viability of what's in the plurality. So the highlighting of other values, of highlighting social justice, is just meant to point out that we are a community of people, interrelated. Then I think highlighting other values will help questions such as, what does bioethics have to say about this? What can bioethics do about these types of day-to-day problems that don't have the classic bioethic tinge to them? This gives us entree into that discussion and gives us, if we reorient our principles, a moral authority on which to stand. And as some people talked about in their discussion, we saw some of this with the health policy. We saw some of this with the lesbian health rights organization that Dr. Redhawk talked about. There are some voices that bubble to the surface and do express a reorientation of values. Argument is just that it has to be broadened. So ideas to take home. I like this, the reflexivity of the idea of saying, I am different for each person I encounter, and the people I encounter are different for each other person. And that's something that Weingarten talks about. And I think it should be liberating, not constricting. Seeing others as equals does not eliminate the asymmetry of healthcare provider-patient relationships. He talks about the difference based on covenant, not a difference based on moral standing, which is where a lot of those sometimes bioethics dilemmas are resolved. Talks about the quest for trust being greater than the search for truth in terms of interpersonal healthcare practitioner patient interactions. And he talks a lot about humility over hubris, which brings us back again to week one, when we illustrated the case of Leah Lee, and talking about what do we do in bioethics, what do we do in medicine with the story of the person, which is so often, as he said, fought against in medicine. We had weeks where we talked about medical competency in large part involving a systematic discounting of the individual patient's narrative. So what do we do with that? What does competence mean with the qualifier of cultural? And I'm going to bring us back to this quote between an MD and a psychotherapist who both work with the Hmong, and they're debating and they're talking about Leah Lee's care. You have to act on behalf of the most vulnerable person in the situation, said Bill, and that's the child. The child's welfare is more important than the patient's beliefs. You have to do what's best for the child, even if the parents oppose it, because if the child dies, she won't get the chance to decide 20 years down the road if she wants to accept her parents' beliefs or if she wants to reject them. She is going to be dead. Well, said Suki tartly, that's the job you have taken on in your profession. I'd feel the same way if I weren't a doctor, said Bill. I would feel I am my brother's keeper. That's tyranny, said Suki. What if you have a family who rejects surgery because they believe an illness has a spiritual cause? What if they see a definite possibility of eternal damnation for their child if she dies from the surgery? Next to that, death might not seem so important. Which is more important, the life or the soul? I make no apology, said Bill. The life comes first. The soul, said Suki. That, I think, we're not going to answer this question, obviously, and my next slide is actually thanks. But the point is I think a lot of talking about cultural competency in medicine and bioethics does relate to that conversation between what is it that we are caring for? What is it that we are paying attention to? Are we paying attention to lives and or souls? How do we define life? How do we define souls? Those are not mutually exclusive things. They can have overlap. But what I've hoped to do over the course of this semester is to give enough tools, theoretical and methodological, the lenses that I'm always talking about that anthropology gives us to look at the world in a slightly different way, to answer that question for ourselves, either as instructors, as future clinicians, as lawyers, as whatever we are, that is an important question to consider, and that both sides have an argument to truth there. So therefore, again, the most important thing is trust, not truth. And focusing on trust over truth does bring us closer to that ideal of pluralism and closer to the ideal of solidarity that are the values that I think a cultural competent medicine and bioethics argues for. I'm going to stop there.